The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. What religion are you? Well, no matter what your answer is, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, Buddhist, Hinduist, or what, that means you are a person who disagrees with a tremendous number of other human beings all over this earth. No matter what political ideology you may cling to, and in which you may fervently believe, that also means you are in total disagreement, sometimes violent disagreement, with many other millions of human beings on this earth. If you are atheistic, agnostic, simply don't know, that still means that you are in disagreement with millions of others around the earth. Now, presumably, whatever you may be, you certainly are not something that is, as you wear your labels, political, social, racial, ethnic, religious, or what, you are not something in which you do not believe. You do not answer the question to yourself or to a friend if they want to know, well, what kind of work are you in, or what kind of church do you go to, what do, what do you think, what do you say, what do you believe. We meet one another with outstretched hands, and we say, hello, how are you? The next thing we want to know is, what is your name? And then, usually, what do you do, or where are you from, when we get acquainted? Perhaps when we, as human beings, have matured to the point that we can appreciate our diversities and our differences, we'll have some of the problems solved that haunt and plague humankind today, but we seem to still be a very far cry away from the point where human beings can appreciate diversification, where they can appreciate differences in each other. But so many people are wound up in either political, social, ethnic, racial, or religious ideologies to the point of virtual bias and hatred against any other individual of different ideologies that it's one of the most enormous problems dividing humankind today. You look around the world, you see the flames of warfare tearing apart nations such as that of Lebanon, which recently has been torn, rocked back and forth, tugged to and fro between the powerful conflicting forces of religion and of politics, in that most volatile of all areas of the world, in the Middle East. We see the unbelievable spectacle of so-called Christian gunmen, as they're called in the news, and you keep hearing it all the time, behind their roadblocks, shooting mortars, hand grenades, anti-tank weapons, rifles, and pistols at Muslims, and vice versa. Or you see the spectacle in Northern Ireland of Catholics against Protestants, all of whom supposedly believe in the same Jesus Christ of Nazareth, though they may not believe in the same method of his birth, or the worship of statues, or what have you. But they are nevertheless supposedly, according to the Muslims, according to the Jews, according to agnostics and atheists, they are all supposedly, quote, Christian, end quote, belonging to different branches of the so-called Christian religion, and they are busily killing one another. So when I ask the question, what are you? I don't think that it's an unfair question. Of course, it's not a socially acceptable question. I realize that. That's not the first question you hit somebody with over cocktails. But it's a question people volunteer. I remember so well talking to a man in the media business who volunteered to me one time. He said, I was born, and then he said the name of his church. I forget whether it was Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, or Catholic. But he said, I was born, and he gave the name of one of these very large denominations. And I thought, now isn't that strange that people take the point of view that you are born into a religion, when a religion is not a race, and when a religion is not like a birth certificate, or it is not a birthright, it is not some badge of belonging to a certain political entity or a social group or another, but religion is supposedly a method and a way by which a man recognizes a power greater than himself, by which a man speculates, muses, ponders, wonders about a power beyond human understanding, about life after death, about saints and angels, about devils and demons, about heaven and hell, about a coming millennium or a kingdom of God or the hereafter or the end of the world or whatever you're talking about, that other world or the spiritual realm in which religion really dwells, the idea that there is a God and perhaps that God is a member of a family or there may be more than one or perhaps it was a father and son. Some people think three. Some people think many members, I suppose, of a God-like family. But religion, in all of its various guises, is nevertheless having to do with the life after death, and with that which lies in a realm outside of human understanding through the five senses. Now, how can you be born into such a philosophy when such philosophies are mature philosophies given to mature men after mature pondering and introspective thought? How in the world can a tiny baby who doesn't even know what race he is, doesn't know what his name is, doesn't know what he is, doesn't know what the world is, where he's going, or anything at all, because a little baby's mind is absolutely blank. A baby is born a collection of rather violent emotions and uncontrollable physical processes. But a baby is not born into a religion. Oh, they may think they are, and they may say that later because we casually take for granted the idea that we were born into a certain religion, but you can't be born into a religion. A religion is a method of answering those imponderable and unanswerable questions that man cannot answer scientifically, as well as a method and a way of worship toward that deity, that divinity, that great being you believe brought into being all things that you can know. But people still say they are born into this or that religion. Now, did you ever really ponder the roots of your belief? Did you ever wonder why you believe the things you do? Why do you believe what you do about politics or about race or about history, for that matter? And especially about religion. How much of what you believe is what you have seen in black and white or red ink or what have you in the pages of those source materials that you hold to be true? How much, on the other hand, of what you say you believe has come to you as naturally and as automatically as some of the other social customs, some of the other ethnic or racial concepts, some of the other political ideologies that you have come to accept? Maybe your parents were hardworking, thrifty, and honest people. Perhaps you, therefore, still have a little bit of the American Protestant work ethic, as it's called. You believe you should be thrifty and honest and hardworking. But you probably do not believe so because you argued it, you debated it, you went to college and studied it, you went through all sorts of psychology books, and you discovered that that is the best way for you, but rather you are the product of an environment, the product of a certain amount of heredity, the product of a parental example, and therefore you simply are that way. Now, to what degree, when you talk about religion, have you ever gone through and proved what you believe? I am always amazed when I ask people in public audiences who have believed various things about which day it is on which they ought to worship, about whether or not some of the pagan holidays of this world are really Christian, about whether or not the Ten Commandments and the law of God are really extant, alive, active, and whether they are to be obeyed today or not, whether or not you really go to heaven or someplace else, whether or not you have an immortal soul or something else. And I asked for a showing of hands. I have asked people, for example, in large public audiences, how many of you have ever heard a sermon where the minister has just waded back and forth through the Bible, through the Scriptures? He has shown you Old Testament examples for it. He has shown you New Testament examples. He showed you how Christ kept Sunday, how the Apostle Paul kept Sunday, how James and Jude and John kept Sunday. Showed you all these examples through the writings of Paul and Peter and John. He showed you all of Christ's statements and the practices of the early New Testament apostles. Showed you how they carried it over in the Old Testament. And just waded through a really good, deep Bible study on why you people are sitting here in church on Sunday. I've never had a hand go up in all the history of asking that question of tens of thousands upon tens of thousands of people. Never once have I seen a hand go up, because, of course, it's utterly impossible. The Sabbath, everybody knows, was kept by all of Israel through the entirety of the Old Testament. That is, when I say kept, I mean that those who were righteous and obedient to God and kings such as David, Hezekiah, and others. There were those like wicked King Manasseh and others who, of course, set up Baal worship in even a different day and different kinds of religion for which they and the nation were cursed. But the practice that was delivered not only prior to Sinai, and which was extant clear back at the very beginning of creation, which is why the fourth commandment says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, meaning it already had been made holy and something you look back to remember that it was made holy. But then I show that in the New Testament, Jesus obviously kept the Sabbath. You can prove that. that he says in Mark 2:27, he is Lord of the Sabbath day. That's the day that is the Lord's day, therefore. And show how through the entirety of the New Testament, the Apostle Paul taught the keeping of the Sabbath to the Gentiles, that the days of unleavened bread were observed, the Passover was observed, the Day of Atonement is mentioned in the book of Acts in the 27th chapter, when the fast was passed and sailing is now dangerous. Let us therefore keep the feast, in 1 Corinthians 5, says the Apostle Paul, of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. How Jesus was walking in Solomon's porch on the temple at that last great day of the feast, which is the Feast of Tabernacles, and preached one of his powerful messages about the Holy Spirit as rivers of living water. And I show by contrarywise or by juxtaposition to the idea of there being any Sunday keeping that if a minister were to simply ask what day was established at creation, reconfirmed to Israel at the foot of Mount Sinai, confirmed to the nation of Israel under righteous kings, which was the identifying sign between them and God, the day for which they were given great blessings if they kept it, and great cursings and the death sentence if they did not, even prior to Mount Sinai, the day kept by all the righteous patriarchs, judges, prophets of old throughout the entirety of the Old Testament, the day in the prophecies of Isaiah, of which it says even eunuchs, those who were not allowed in the tabernacle and in the camp of Israel, strangers, foreigners, Gentiles, if they laid hold on and kept their feet off of God's holy Sabbath day, would be given a name better than sons and daughters and would ride the high places of the earth and inherit the very kingdom of God. That's Old Testament language. The day of which Christ is Lord, the day the Apostle Paul kept and taught the Gentiles to keep. Now, if you wanted to talk about asking a minister to preach from the Bible about which day is to be obeyed, believed, and observed by New Testament Christians, well, then you'd have some scriptural backing for that kind of a sermon. You'd have a lot of material. I mean, you could go through a book that you could get off the library shelves. You could go to the theology department of some big public library and just look up books on the Sabbath. And you could study those. And then you could look up some of the encyclopedic works, including the Catholic Encyclopedia and others, about Sunday, and find out where it began, and who changed it, and by which edict, by which king, or which great leader of a pagan empire was that day enforced upon New Testament Christians under pain of death. You can then ask yourselves about the Council of Laodicea and the Council of Nicaea, and that fateful date of 325 A.D., when there was a statement that came out that said words to the effect that Christians shall not be found Judaizing by observing the Passover on the 14th or the weekly Sabbath day, and where that was an edict where people were told under threat of death they were not to observe that day, which had been observed through the entirety of the 1st century, the 2nd century, the 3rd century, and for that matter went underground and continued to be observed by God's true people from that day clear on down into the present time. And where vestiges and remnants of some of those groups that observed that day are found even to this day in Italy and parts of Europe, called Valdensians, apparently a carryover from the days of Peter Waldo, way back in the Middle Ages, when there were still groups of people who believed in keeping that day. Isn't it a little bit perplexing to you that when you think about some of the major doctrines of so-called Christianity, you have never heard sermons proving them? Now, for example, you're not going to hear a sermon. You haven't heard a sermon. You won't hear a sermon, as I said, wading through Old and New Testament, proving to you that Sunday is a day you ought to be sitting in church. Now, secondly, you have never heard and you never will hear a sermon wading through the Bible proving you have an immortal soul. First, the words immortal soul are not found in the Bible. So no minister is going to be able to even find as a reference work, is not going to be able to go to the theology department of a big library, cannot go to an exhaustive concordance, cannot go to reference material in the back of a rather complete Bible that might have an index in the back of it. He cannot go to any translation and find the words immortal soul. They just aren't there. So you're kind of stymied. Let's say that you're a beginning preacher. Now, if I were a beginning preacher in a pulpit and I'd been hired, you know, by somebody to preach what he tells me to preach, I would certainly want to go out and earn my keep fairly and honestly. And I would want to do a good job for the fellow that pays my salary. And if he told me, okay, Ted, now this week I want you to preach a sermon on the rapture, and I want you to prove to all those people out there in that congregation that Jesus is going to come and rapture away the saints. And I'd say, okay, their vicar or whatever his name might be, or right rev or somebody, you know, we have these titles, whatever his title might be. And with a flick of my frock, I would turn around and settle myself comfortably into my study chair, and I would go about the business of trying rather desperately and frantically, because that's what the search would finally really degenerate into, to find the word rapture in the Bible. And I would look and I would search and I would pour through, because I have exhaustive concordances, a couple, three different kinds, and the Greek interlinears, and the diaglots and polyglots and all of that. And I have a rather extensive personal library, but I have at my disposal the vast libraries of both Ambassador College campuses, who have great schools in theology, and also at my disposal doctors in all these various research areas, men with degrees, and I would even ask for their help. And we would search until we're blue in the face and my fingernails are worn off to my elbows and all that, trying to find, frantically paging through the Bible, wearing out one Bible after another, probably tearing the pages in our frantic search because it's getting closer to Sunday. I haven't started to research that yet. You understand, I've been told to preach on the rapture first, so I haven't got to that yet. And I can't find it. Isn't there. The word isn't even in the Bible. And instead of finding out about a secret coming, I decide, well, if I can't find the word rapture, I'll look up the word about the second coming of Christ. And if I do that, I'll probably discover there are three separate Greek words. And I will discover that those are used rather liberally throughout the New Testament in connection with the second coming of Jesus Christ. Epiphaneia, apokalypsis, and parousia. And I will discover that there is a word like in the English that we call epiphany. And there is the word which is labeled in the book of Revelation, revelation, from the Greek word apocalypse, which means not holocaust. A lot of people think it does, but that's because I haven't looked it up. But it means revelation, a revealing. And it talks about the revealing of the Lord, and it uses the Greek word apokalypsis. And then I will find that, strangely enough, there is a word about in his presence, meaning his parousia. And I will discover that some of those who believe in the idea of the rapture would like me to believe that the word parousia is always used in connection with a rather secret, clandestine coming of Jesus Christ, but is never used as a time when violent, unbelievable, huge, cataclysmic things are occurring, to the outpouring of plagues and the blast of heavenly trumpets and the rending of the heavens and men falling down begging for the rocks to fall on them, as it seems to say in the book of Revelation, which is called Apocalypsis. But then I would have to disagree with those men, because my search would take me to places like Matthew 24. And it says in verse 37, as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. And I would find the word coming is translated from the word parousia in the Greek language, and that the coming of the Son of Man is described in the 24th chapter as a time when, as lightning comes out of the east and shines out of the west, that's the way it is going to be. That if they say he's in the secret chambers, don't believe it, but it says in verse 27, as the lightning comes out of the east and shines even unto the west, so shall also the coming, again the Greek word is parousia, of the Son of Man be. Then it talks about the darkening of those days, the sun not giving her light, the sun dark, black, and sackcloth of ashes, the stars falling from heavens, and it says, the Son of Man shall appear, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Verse 30, part of the same context. That will be the coming of the Son of Man, the one word that I would have discovered in my research. Some of these fellows like to use to indicate a so-called rapture theory, a kind of a secret disappearance of the saints. But my research would show me that it says in verse 31, in connection with that coming of Jesus Christ in power and great glory, quote, he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now that's on the earth, under heaven, if you want to look it up and check it for yourself, because he talks about people on this earth, one grinding and one is taken, the other left, one woman up doing her daily chores, and she is taken, and the other is left. And it says, of that day and that hour knoweth no man, and beginning in verse 37, as the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. And then it describes the days of the flood when they were living life normally, eating, drinking, marrying, and giving in marriage. And they knew not until the flood came. So shall the coming, again parousia, verse 39, of the Son of Man be. My research would be a little futile, because I would be unable to discover a single place in the Bible where the word rapture is ever used in that connection whatsoever. And then I would discover that the second coming of Christ is accompanied by loud earth-rending earthquakes, by giant heavenly signs, by huge smoking pillars of fire running along the ground, by 90-some pound hailstones striking men and killing people on the earth, by the rending of the heavens and armies pouring out of heavens on horses and angels, and Jesus appearing as the heavens are rent, and it says every eye shall see him, and he comes in power and great glory, and I will be unable to determine that there is any first coming in a phase and then a second coming in another phase, but I will discover instead that Christ is going to come at the culmination of a time called the Day of the Lord after a time of great tribulation. And I will discover, as I look in the 29th verse of that same chapter, that the tribulation is before the heavenly signs. And I will discover that the whole doctrine, the whole idea of a so-called rapture theory is thrown out the window and is thrown into a cocked hat, is knocked in the head and cut down to be absolutely ludicrous by only two scriptures in the Bible. And those are Matthew 24, verse 29, and Joel 2, and verse 31. If you'd care to look them up, that's all you need to be a Bible student to totally do away with the idea of the secret rapture. And that happens to be in Matthew 24, 29, and Joel 2, 31. You see, the idea of the rapture is promulgated by those who claim that the saints are protected from. They are spirited away from the earth and concealed and hidden and protected from the great tribulation. But take a look, because the idea seems to be the tribulation and the day of the Lord are one and the same thing. But the Bible shows in the book of Revelation that tribulation is the day of Satan's wrath. Then comes the outpouring of heavenly signs and a halting of human activity and the sealing of the 144,000 and the great innumerable multitude of the sixth chapter of Revelation. Saints, people in whom is the Spirit of God, still on the earth after the tribulation. During the heavenly signs they are sealed, and then comes the day of the Lord, and finally, after the third woe, and the third of those last three woes are the last three of the seven trumpet plagues, after the third woe, which is divided into seven last plagues, Jesus Christ comes for the second time only. It says in Matthew 24:29, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. Okay? Heavenly signs after the tribulation. Joel 2:31 says, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. Now, no minister in his right mind is going to be able to gainsay, rip out of the Bible, or blue pencil those two simple scriptures which knock the idea of there being a secret rapture right in the side of the head. It's just a ridiculous idea. That's all there is to it. Now, it might be a false hope. It might be a vague idea. It might be a good idea to some people. It just happens to be that's not the way God's going to work it out. That's all. So I would really be frustrated. Now, what if I were trying to prove to somebody about going to heaven? Well, there again, I'd have a horrible problem. I'd go to my reference works, and I'd want to get all the scriptures which said, when I see you in heaven, or the saints will be in heaven, or when we get to heaven, or are you going to heaven, or shall we go to heaven together, or are you going to bring Martha and the kids, and shall we meet up there on the other side? Now, I could find all that stuff in some Protestant hymnals and maybe some songbooks. I could find it in poetry, and I could find it in religious literature. I could find it in people writing about deathbed scenes of an ancient elderly person who died, but I wouldn't be able to find it in the Bible. And I would, again, be totally frustrated in my search, because instead of that, I would find where Jesus says, no man hath ascended into heaven. Then I would find how Peter, preaching on the day of Pentecost, and you find that in the second chapter of the book of Acts, would talk about one of the most righteous men in the Old Testament, A man who was actually called the King of Israel and is going to be resurrected to sit on the throne and to rule over them according to Jesus Christ in his own words and according to the chapter of Jeremiah that talks about the resurrection and King David being brought back to sit on a throne and to judge and to rule over Israel. But instead, I would find Peter saying in verse 29 of Acts 2, "Men and brethren, let me freely speak unto you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his sepulcher is with us unto this day." Now, if Peter left it alone, there would be no problem for me. I could probably still reason around, well, yeah, his body was dead. Sure, Peter was dead, and obviously there had to be a sepulcher to contain his body, but you see, his soul was off up there someplace. See, you see, David, the real David, well, he had gone to heaven, but just his body is buried, and that's what Peter's talking about. But I'm telling you, that Peter was impetuous, wasn't he? He just couldn't leave a subject well enough alone. Now, if he hadn't gone ahead and just clarified it a little later on at the end of that sermon, I suppose there could be preachers today that would argue with their congregations that, well, maybe David's body was there, but his soul wasn't. But unfortunately, Peter had to go on and really stick his foot in it a little later on. And he said in verse 34 of the second chapter of Acts, "For David is not ascended into the heavens." How about that? So David isn't up there. Then I would find in the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews how even though the Apostle Paul eulogizes and goes through a whole stream of some of the greatest men in all of history, including some of the greatest women in all the Old Testament, who wandered about in goatskins and sheepskins, destitute and afflicted, of whom the world was not worthy, who were martyred, who gave up their lives for their faith. And he would talk about, oh, everybody from Noah right on down to the great prophets of Jeremiah and Isaiah and Elijah and Moses and so on, great men of the Bible. And then he would say twice, repeatedly, "These all died not having received the promise." And then I would read in the New Testament in the Sermon on the Mount how Jesus said, "The meek shall inherit the earth." And then I'd read how Christ is coming back to the earth. And again, I'd be utterly frustrated if I was trying to hire out my Bible to somebody to preach some of these doctrines that you can't find. Did you ever really wonder about where you got the things you believe? Have you ever heard sermons absolutely proving your beliefs to you? Have you ever studied them? You ever looked them up? You ever proved them to yourself one way or the other? I don't see anything wrong with proving what you believe and knowing where you stand. We have a whole series of new booklets that I've announced from time to time called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse of the Book of Revelation. And one of the latest ones is called The White Horse, False Religion. And you will be absolutely amazed when you find out that even the Bible prophesies exactly what you see about you today in the entirety of Christianity and, for that matter, all other religions. You can have that booklet, The White Horse, False Religion. You can have the whole series on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, for that matter. Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, is all the address you need for your free copy of that booklet, False Religion. There's no price, no follow-up, no charge, whatever. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying, don't believe everything you hear.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests, along with the call letters of this station, to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.